No, he won't take it, said a voice out loud. No, we won't take it, we will stand our ground. No, we won't.
Good morning and welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show, where we the people are now in session. We have a great show coming up for you today. In the first hour, we have Yuri Raskin with Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup to talk about the weekly news. I'll have Capper on after that, otherwise known as Chris Liebenthal from Cognitive Dissidence, and he'll join Yuri and I to discuss the updates in the John Doe investigation. After Capper, we'll have geologist Jason Huberty and geochemist Joel Scullin, they will finish out the hour. They'll be talking about the science behind the Pinoki Mountain Range mine. In the second hour, I will start the hour with Zach from Blogging Blue and Kelly from Politiscope. We'll be discussing the week's news along with their newest blogs. And I will finish off the hour with Christine Newman from Vocals de la Frontera, and I'm sure I said that wrong, and I know she will correct me. I'm sorry. I did not take Spanish, I have to admit. I took 4 years of German, which is really great in Germany and in maybe some places in Wisconsin, but it's not going to help me with that name. So I know she'll correct me on this. Anyway, we'll be talking about the redistricting maps, the redistricting lawsuits that they have out, and what is going on with the Latino population in Milwaukee. The phone number to call in if you have any questions is 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896. We also have a live discussion online at blogtalkradio.com. You can post your comments or questions there, and I will try to get them on the air. Now, I have a quick announcement. I am very excited to announce that the Sarah Schultz Show can now be heard on Sundays at 8 a.m. on WFAQ 92.9 LPFM in Mukwonago, Waukesha. So if you're up in the Mukwonago, Waukesha, East Troy, Palmyra area, way up there, or at least a little further up there than I am, listen in 8 a.m. Sundays, 92.9 LPFM. Now I'd like to welcome Yuri Raskin to the Sarah Schultz Show. Good morning, Yuri.
Good morning, Sarah. How are you doing?
I am wonderful. How are you doing this morning?
I am doing well as well, and congratulations to all the listeners in Mukwonago who will now be able to enjoy the Sarah Schultz Show.
Yeah, I'm really excited. Mukwonago, Waukesha, it's the only way I'm going to get into my county, which is Walworth County. It dips in a little bit into Walworth. Other than that, I'm just kind of, hopefully they'll all listen online, because there's just nothing here I can get on.
Well, if that's what people have to do, darn it, that's what people have to do. So, we have some news, and it's been a busy week. For starters, I guess, there's been some rallies around the state, and it was great seeing you on, at least Tuesday, it was, in Elkhorn, where there was a candlelight vigil, really in support of teachers, but also in support of Ellen Hawley, who has been a tremendous organizer over the past year, and it's really just a part of all the charitable work that she does. I talked to her a little bit in times past, and it's just amazing how much this woman is able to do. So when she started to get these harassment letters and in general just getting bothered for her political activity, lots of people came down to Elkhorn, and we had a great rally. You were there to record it. It was a great time.
It was a lot of fun. We had a lot of people from Walworth. We also had people come in from all over the area, and it was a support for Ellen. It was 1 year ago we had a rally in support of teachers and against the Walker budget, and it was to kind of show solidarity still that, hey, we're still here. I know this is a red county, but we are still here. So it was really nice to see everyone. There was something like 400 people that came to that. That was really exciting. So I was very happy to see you. It was a pleasant surprise. And, yeah, I actually have some audio clips from, I'm hoping to play from that today. So
excellent. Well, these protests, they, you know, I have a pretty small family, but it feels like every one of these is a family reunion. So that's always, you know, that's always a good thing. So we have our wonderful Senate, wonderful being in major quote marks, the state Senate, passed new rules governing abortion services in Wisconsin, which is just despicable, because there's certain things I think that we've a lot of people have come to take for granted, that there's going to be certain services and certain respect that we're going to have for women in Wisconsin. And then we have Senate and Assembly come out just saying, nope, everything's up for grabs, everything's up for debate. They had a vote on the measure which came after Democrats delayed action on Tuesday with a procedural move. And now we have a bill that prohibits so-called webcam abortions and requires doctors perform physical exams prior to performing abortions. The author is New Berlin Republican Senator Mary Lasich. To have a loophole in our law which allows new technology, webcam abortions, to give women a lesser standard of care to get medication without having a physical, we should not be allowing that loophole in our law, Senator says.
The webcam, yeah. You want an abortion, you're talking to webcam and it happens? I mean, I understand what the bill is. The bill is basically if you were somewhere away and you want to consult a doctor, you could actually consult them on the webcam to talk with them, and then you can go and do it. It was basically the gist of it. But to suggest that that's a lesser care than talking to the doctor face-to-face in the office is insulting. And the fact that there are places that maybe you have a webcam, but you don't have a place around you except for 4 hours or whatever, and you need to do it that way. It's just limiting women.
Well, I kind of think about all the latest developments in technology where we have, you know, we're talk about how exciting it is that a surgeon can be miles or, you know, hundreds, thousands of miles away and provide quality care, including doing surgery in a place where they're not actually present. And I guess we're questioning all of that as well. I mean, we're putting entire medical technology up for debate because really there's one purpose, which is to limit ability of women to make difficult choices. And it's just, it's insane. So the bills, you know, they can frame it however they want, but the dynamics of this battle, you know, and it's so interesting that so many of these bills are coming up almost to the day in several states, that we're all of a sudden this statewide battle becomes a national battle, and it just highlights how much we're all interconnected and how much organizations like ALEC are running the show now all across the nation. So
it is. It's you know, it's yeah. A sad state. And really, Wisconsin, as it always has been, is the testing ground for all these things. We have they've tried between Wisconsin and Ohio and Michigan, they've released different same bills in different ways to see what works and what doesn't, and it's really sickening.
Mm-hmm. We have now governor that said that he's going to use part of the mortgage settlement, and I'm jumping from things to things just because we have a limited amount of time, but each one of these could probably warrant its own two-hour discussion. But we have mayors of several cities in Wisconsin that came out opposed and calling on Governor Walker not to use $25 million of the $31 million from federal foreclosure settlement to fix a hole in the state budget. You know, Janesville, obviously, we don't have a mayor, but as a council member, it's just, you know, again, we have a governor that pays, you know, that says that he's not going to use things for things that they're not appropriated for and turns around and does that very same thing right here with mortgages, where the money is allocated for one thing, and he says, that's okay, we're going to use it for something else.
Right. I need to fill the hole in my budget. So instead of helping out the homeowners that are struggling or have lost their homes to try to get them a place to stay, I'm just going to stick it in the budget, and hopefully I don't have to write up a budget repair bill.
Yep.
That's what Walker wants to do with it.
Next story that we have proof of voter fraud in Wisconsin in the assembly. And this is something that our friend Arthur gets a huge amount of credit for. I think his videos now have been viewed over 17,000 times. And basically he went out there, and I think it's with an iCam, you know, iPhone, and just recorded Representative Clay Fish, who is husband of our current lieutenant governor, going and voting, casting votes for two other absent Republican legislators. And there's so many interesting aspects to that, because I've been hearing complaints from different protesters who were there and kind of exposed to state politics for the first time coming up to me and saying, Yuri, is this right? I see people going voting for people that are not there all the time. This just seems wrong. But isn't it amazing that when you capture it on video, all of a sudden, it's just one picture is worth a thousand words. And even though this is done by both by Republicans and Democrats, according to some of the news reports, the system is broken. The system is broken, and when you have a representative just marching over, and even when he's caught on camera, he sits there and not really, can't even tell if he's nervous or not, but he looks like he's done this all the time.
Well, and it actually is against the law in the assembly to vote for a member who is not present during voting. It is, and I know, you know, people say both sides do it, but you know what, who got caught? Representative Clayton.
Right.
He's the one that got caught. He got, if you're an assembly member, Jesus, can you at least go in and make sure you're there for your vote? Can you sit at your chair and just say, hey, I'll wait until it votes, then I'll go and do whatever I have to do? I mean, that's what the people pay you for. The people don't pay you to have one of your buddies go and do a down the party vote for you.
Well, and as I have been researching for my own personal selfish reasons and learning more about state government, my gosh, this is not a 40-hour-a-week job as far as spending your time in the Capitol. So why not find a little bit of time to do the job and actually sit and vote? Even though we know that Republicans are going to march to their rubber stamping orders and they know how they're going to vote, I guess it kind of highlights the fact of what extent they're all on the same page. But really, why not stay there and vote?
I'm sure you could take a break right after voting, because they do. There's a little bit of a break. You vote, you go run to the bathroom. Or you vote, you go and eat. You vote and go call your girlfriend. I don't know what you're doing, but
you know, that's a really interesting point is you bring up, because I'm thinking, wow, what are they serving in the cafeteria if like two out of three legislators couldn't even stick around?
You know, I don't know. I'm going to have to check. When about half of them leave, I'm going to have to run down there and see if it's some, like, filet mignon or something.
Exactly.
Maybe it's something
so they'd rather do something really good or something really bad. You figure it out, you know.
Well,
but it's might as well make up some jokes, because the reality is they're not voting.
It's a sad reality, really. Speaking of legislatures that are missing, I want to read to you what's going on the 29th. I'm going to read this, obviously, to everybody. I'm sure, Yuri, you've run into this. It's Wisconsin night in Washington, D.C. You are cordially invited to attend a reception in support of the Republican Party of Wisconsin with hosts Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald and Joint Finance Co-Chair Representative Robin Voss, along with Speaker Jeff Fitzgerald, Assistant Leaders Representative Scott Souter and Senator Glenn Grothman, and Joint Finance Co-Chair Senator Alberta Darling, Wednesday, February 29th, 2012, 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Barber, Griffiths & Rogers, LLC, the Homer Building, 11th floor south, 601 13th Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20005. Invited guests are Senator Ron Johnson, Congressman Sean Duffy, Congressman Tom Petrie, Congressman Reed Ribble, Congressman Paul Ryan, and Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner. It's $5,000 to host, $2,500 to sponsor, and $1,000 per person to attend. All PAC and individual donations are appreciated. If you want to RSVP, here, you can RSVP to Judy Rose.
Oh, thank you. Please provide me the RSVP information. That's so important. Yes, please go ahead.
I thought I would do it just in case anyone wants to. 608-257-8035 or Melanie Hubbard at 608-279-1275 or at the Republican Party of Wisconsin. There we go. So anyone who wants to reserve their seats, you are more than welcome to do that and go visit Washington, D.C. and, you know, have
a
good time.
It's a beautiful city.
It is a beautiful city. It would be a lot more beautiful if our representatives weren't always there, but, you know, except the ones who are supposed to be. The congressmen, I see. I can understand them being there. But the rest of them are state senators. Maybe someone will vote for them while they're gone. I don't know.
Hey, there's some probably left behind so they can vote, but I presume that their legislature will be out of session. You know, this just highlights the business of politics and what a dirty business it can be. It's so much of this is about money, so they have to really show their work. It's like, you bring your homework back to teacher, and they say, show your work. Well, here it is. You know, we voted for all these things. Now give us our money, please. We stood up to those union bosses and all those, people. And now we want our just rewards, please. It's sad, but it's the world we live in.
It is. I got that. I just want to say I got that information off of Chris Liebenthal's blog, Cognitive Dissidence. And I'd like to bring Chris into this. So I'd like to welcome Chris Liebenthal. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Sarah. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well today.
Good. We have Yuri here with us, so Yuri might ask you a couple questions, but I know we're going to talk about John Doe, so let's get right into it. What is new in the John Doe investigation the last week or so?
Well, Tilly Reinflesch is one of the people that has been charged with campaigning during county time while she was working for Scott Walker at Milwaukee County. Had her preliminary hearing this past week, and the defense counsel used some interesting methodology to try to get the case dismissed. He was arguing that because she gave testimony 10 years ago in the Crockett scandal and she was doing the same thing, that it shouldn't be used in this case, even though it's a whole separate matter. The judge saw right through that and said things could proceed. The other thing that was interesting was that one of the big questions regarding Ms. Reinflesch was that nobody knew who was hiring her, who had hired her for the county. Well, documentation has shown that it was Scott Walker that signed off on her employment papers, which would indicate that he was the one that hired him for this position without bothering to tell his chief of staff or anybody else in his office that she was working for him now.
Wasn't he the one, though, that was saying, I don't remember, I don't know about her? Wasn't he, Scott Walker, the one saying that? I know the other ones were.
Well, I know that Tom Nardelli, who was Walker's chief of staff and the direct supervisor for Kelly Reinflesch, didn't know who had hired her and didn't even know she was working there. Likewise, the county board wasn't even aware that she was working until months later when she suddenly appeared and nobody knew who she was. Walker himself has been pretty much evading the question. You know, when asked directly, he just would dance around it and not answer the question.
Hey, Chris. This
yes.
is Yuri. Big fan of your blog. I actually really like the cataloging of Walker failures that you've had under your category of the Walker budget is working and all the various parts. I think it's really important that those are just listed. But I was really curious, to me, I think really probably the biggest name and probably many others is Tim Russell. You know, he and Scott Walker go way back to Marquette, and now it sounds like Tim Russell is really, from what I'm hearing, a major target of this investigation as well, in part because of his significant other who is accused of enticing a 17-year-old. And that's possibly, I guess, it might be being used to get more information on Scott Walker. What are you hearing there?
Well, what I'm hearing is that, well, Tim Russell was involved in almost everything that's been happening that has been released publicly so far. Not only was he involved with his partner who had these child enticement charges, and all indications show that he was aware of what was happening and was actually, participating in this. But he also has been, of course, charged with embezzling funds from the Veterans Fund that was supposed to be used to help honor veterans at Milwaukee County Zoo every year. He was embezzling from other political campaigns, which he was doing while he was on county time. He is also the one that set up the secret router system and the secret email system that's been, a center of this that they were using for their campaign purposes and to avoid open records requests. I've heard that Mr. Russell is they're putting pressure on Mr. Russell to churn and talk about everything he knows about Scott Walker. My instincts were to say that he wouldn't churn because they were such close friends and very tight. But now that he's in this really tight pickle, it appears that the Walker, Scott Walker and his administration and his campaign are kind of leaving Russell out to hang and aren't giving him a lot of support, and he's a little upset about that.
Well, that would be very interesting because from my sources I understand that they went on vacations together. So, violations that Tim Russell has been engaged in, allegedly, would just lead one to believe that he feels, number one, that he is not going to get punished, therefore he's got a high level of protection, and also that his work is very important and very secretive. So,
has been involved with all of Walker's campaigns, either as county executive or, as you mentioned, with Marquette. Sort of setting up a pattern for Walker is also that he knew Tim Russell was discharged or terminated from state employment back in the 90s when he worked at WEDA for using a state credit card for personal uses. But I have been also told that Walker and Russell have taken vacations together to New Orleans or wherever else, and that they spend a lot of time together. So there is definitely a close friendship anyway. What the current status of that friendship is, I don't know for sure, but like I said, I've been hearing that there's been some hard feelings between the two.
Has anything come from the dumpster full of paper that they found locked up underneath the driving, the parking garage?
All I know for certain is that when they were initially going through the papers at the dumpster, you know, when they found and opened up the locked dumpster, is that a reference was made to, yeah, these are the things we're looking for. As far as to what exactly those papers are, that hasn't been released, and nobody's been talking about it whatsoever. My best guess would be that these were the papers that came up missing shortly after Walker left office as Milwaukee County Executive. There was a report in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel in early January of 2011 stating that boxes and boxes of files were missing, as well as computers from the executive's office. To the best of my knowledge, the last contact I had with anybody aware of that, those boxes had not been retrieved yet. So it would make a lot of sense that this dumpster contained those files that apparently the Walker administration didn't want anybody to see.
Well, they found them now, so that should be interesting if that plays out, what they're finding in there.
I've also heard that Mr. Walker is going to be coming in the next week or so to, using air quotes here, cooperate with the DA's office and helping with their investigation.
Again?
I don't think he's actually met with the DA yet, but that has been scheduled from what I understand.
Well, it's so nice that he, air quote, cooperates with the DA. Had to throw that in there, too.
Real, you know, such a helpful man he is.
Such a nice guy.
So where do you anticipate this whole thing heading at this point? What should we expect to hear next, and what could be the next shoe to drop?
Well, there's a few other things that are still being part of an ongoing investigation as part of this John Doe. One of the things is a possible pay-for-play deal with rental properties. If you remember, towards the end of last year, major Milwaukee area real estate mogul, Andrew Jensen, was jailed overnight at the Milwaukee County Jail for not cooperating with the John Doe investigation. It's been reported that Jensen, Walker's campaign treasurer until last year, John Hiller, another Walker associate and longtime aide to Walker, both in his campaign and to his administrations, Jim Villa, are all involved with this pay-for-play where a county agency was being housed in a rather expensive office building downtown, which Hiller was the representative for. Russell was involved with that deal as well, trying, you know, making sure that deal went through, where Milwaukee County was giving, paying through the nose to rent this space, where Villa, Hiller, and Jensen all profited from.
Okay.
And these same individuals were helping his campaign at the same time. I know that's being looked into, but I think that the big thing everybody's looking at, and I'm not the only one saying this anymore, is that Scott Walker is John Doe.
Right. Chris, what is the main thing that
John...
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, the way John Doe's work is they start at the bottom and build their cases up so that they can help exert pressure on the people they have already charged to flip on the people that are higher up on the food chain. We've got Colin Worry that has immunity, which is Walker's spokesman in the governor's office, and was working at a high level in his campaign for governor. You have Tim Russell, who's all over in the middle of everything, having charges against him and a lot more potential charges that could be filed against him in the future. And I'm sure that's being used as leverage to encourage him to be a little more cooperative.
Sure.
I was just curious,
what have you learned from this? You know, from following the story for so long, what have you learned about politics, about Scott Walker? Is there some fundamental things that, you know, people should know about Scott, you know?
You know, basically Walker is... you know, very much a megalomaniac. Even though he was not directly involved with the caucus scandals as far as being investigated or being charged with anything 10 years ago, he was part of the legislature at that time. His people were involved with it. And he, despite all of the stuff that happened, he continued with those same behaviors. You know, and it's just that he's got this certain arrogance about him, this certain feeling of entitlement that he's able to do whatever he wants and get away with it without having any repercussions. He feels he's above the law and above all sorts of ethics. And he's, throughout his career, he's done everything he could to bypass any ethics rules or to manipulate them so that it could have at least the appearance of following the rules when he's actually not.
Do you think Walker is one more rung in the step of John Doe, and John Doe might actually be someone higher? Because I've heard Reince Priebus, you know, Charlie Sykes, and not, he's not really high, but I'm just throwing names out I've heard, but Reince Priebus being a big one, being the RNC chair right now, do you think that that's possibly what's going on, or do you think Rents is just part of the issue and they're really going for Walker?
Well, that would be a real big question, and it's, you know, it's a possibility that Priebus could be the John Doe. His name has been brought up. I did write a post the other day questioning some of the things that was going on, including when Walker went for his motorcycle ride in 2010, the one that he moved up because June is just too warm to ride a motorcycle. He moved it up to the middle of May, just coincidentally ending with the Republican State Convention. Well, now it's turning out that a lot of the people that went on this bike ride with him weren't even county citizens. They were GOP operatives from around the state. The one person in particular that I had talked about had been involved with the caucus scandal back then. And he just, you know, without any hint of consciousness about it, he had this woman coming along. She was talking about how great it was to go travel the state and talk about how great Milwaukee County is. Well, it turns out that this woman was a GOP operative that was working for WISCOP, fundraising for Scott Fitzgerald and his brother, and isn't even, lives in Dane County in Cottage Grove, has nothing to do with Milwaukee County, probably hasn't even been here more than a dozen times in her life. And, so, you know, it would make a lot of sense to think that maybe Priebus had arranged this for all these GOP operatives to go along on the bike ride to make it look better than it really was, sort of act as plants or hired people to fill out the crowd.
Make it, as he did with the State of the State address, put his people around him so it looks good.
Exactly. You know, it was just a way to control the photo ops and control the media and the public impression, but have nothing to do with the actual reality behind the story.
Okay. Well, it is time to go, so thank you so much for being on. I hope we can have you on. Hopefully next week. I've got some great questions from the chat that I can't even get to, so hopefully they'll hold it. I know John's got it, so hold on to those, John. We'll get to those hopefully next week, and hopefully you'll be back on and we can talk more about John Doe and see what has happened in the last week since.
Okay, well, I'll see what I can do. Thank you for having me on these last 2 weeks. So.
Oh, you're welcome.
Good talking to you, Chris.
Real quick, Chris, what's your website so people can keep reading about this?
My website is Cognitive Dissidence. The address is Cogni, C-O-G-N-I, Dissidence, spelled D-I-S-S-I-D-E-N-C-E, .blogspot.com.
Okay. Thank you so much for being on, and definitely we'll try to get you on next week, too.
All right. We'll see. We'll talk.
Okay. We'll talk to you later, Chris.
All right. Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Bye. And I'd also like to say bye to Yuri, who is wonderful. Thank you so much for hanging out with me, Yuri, with Chris. And I know I will talk with you next week.
Sounds great. Take care.
All right. You have a good week now. So you got, that was Chris Liebenthal with Cognitive Dissidence. And he was talking about John Doe, and we got Yuri Rashkin, who we started off the hour with, talking about Weekly News Roundup. And we'll be right back. We will be right back with Joe and Jason talking about the science of the behind the mine in the Pinocchio Range.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The U.S. Postal Service unveiled sweeping changes on Thursday. Jesse Russell reports.
The Postal Service will slash 5.4% of its workforce, amounting to nearly 35,000 workers. The organization will also shutter nearly half of its mail processing plants. Additionally, the Postal Service is asking Congress to allow it to end Saturday service. Postmaster General Patrick Donahue said in a conference call that mail volume declined by 6% in 2011 and is projected to drop an additional 14% by 2016. The facilities that remain open could see mail processing hours increase to 18 hours a day instead of the current 10 or 12 hours per day. The Postal Service doesn't need congressional approval to close processing plants, and there isn't an appeals process as there is when the service tries to close post offices. The majority of the projected Postal Service losses can be attributed to a 2006 congressional mandate that requires 75 years of retiree health benefits to be pre-funded within a decade. That mandate has cost the service $5.5 billion annually.
The University of Virginia has an enormous endowment, so large that every 7 days the endowment generates enough interest to pay all employees at UVA a living wage.
Carl David Gedi-Lusiak is one of the UVA students on a week-long hunger strike for a living wage at the university. They want wages for staff raised from $10.65 to $13 an hour with an annual cost of living adjustment. The living wage campaign at UVA began in 1998. A book co-authored by UVA President Teresa Sullivan said that, quote, being paid a living wage for one's work is a necessary condition for self-actualization. The provision of wages adequate to meet basic needs is a fundamental requirement before a job can be experienced as rewarding and meaningful, end quote. Despite that, so far the university has failed to adopt a living wage. For Gedi-Lusiak and the 17 other hunger strikers, this living wage at UVA is a moral imperative.
This is about the city of Charlottesville. It's about respect, dignity, and equality in my city. But it's also about the United States. It's about an American people that I believe have forgotten their communal sense of purpose. This is about valuing every member in our society, appreciating the work they have. And it's about standing up and imagining the ways in which our world can be more just and more fair.
The International Union of Operating Engineers Local 150 is suing Indiana to block the so-called right-to-work anti-union law. The federal suit seeks a 10-day restraining order until a judge can rule on the suit. The suit alleges a violation of the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause, among other challenges to the law. That's because building and construction trades union members in Indiana are treated differently than public workers there under the anti-union legislation. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz. And on now, I have Joe Scullin. And we're going to be waiting for Jason Huberty to call in.
Yep.
But
I should be calling in.
Okay. Joe Scullin is a geochemist who has studied the rocks and the chemical composition of the rocks in the Pinoki Mountain Range. And you guys had a phenomenal testimony last Friday at the Joint Finance Committee about what you guys found, because I know Jason is a geologist who studied iron ore, and I really want you to go into that. But first, can you give me just a quick bio of yourself?
I'm from Madison originally, but I grew up in upstate New York, and I have a master's in medieval history, and a master's in geology, and a PhD from Berkeley in paleontology and geochemistry. And then I've been working in University of Wisconsin, and I currently work also with Arizona State University on some medical research stemming from some geochemical work I did years ago.
Wow. That's really impressive. You're a teacher now at UW-Madison?
Yeah, I teach two classes at UW-Madison, and then I do – my research affiliation is currently with Arizona State University, where been working on a NASA grant for the past 4 years.
Wow. Now, you testified at the Joint Finance Committee in regards to the chemical composition of the core. You had a core sample, you said, that you had studied. Can you
talk? Well, I had a sample I'd studied, yeah. There are
okay.
core samples. There are core samples in the Wisconsin State Survey, but not from the actual mine site. Then there are core samples that were taken by U.S. Steel Company in the 1950s from the mine site, and no one seems to know where they are. They've been floating around, and we're just getting a lot of contradictory information about where they are and who has them and who's looked at them. But I did look at a sample from near the mine site, several samples from near the mine site. I've also been in contact with some geologists in the area up there who have more extensive knowledge of the rock that is of interest is this formation called the Tyler Shale. And over the past few days, I've learned a little bit more about that. But this is a black shale. It formed in the ocean about 1.8 billion years ago under anoxic conditions. There were, you know, when there was no oxygen on the seafloor, and sulfide minerals precipitated out in the shale. Black shales are the kind of thing that are. It's a type of rock. I mean, most of them are not that old, but you find similar black shales occurring around the world, and they all tend to have similar chemical properties, and they also tend to be high in sulfide, especially, you know, pyrite, iron, ferrous sulfide.
So what does that mean when they're going to talk about mining, when you have the shale? Now, the shale is what the iron ore is in?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's above the iron ore.
The iron ore is a unit called the Ironwood Formation, which is below in northern Wisconsin, because the rocks are so steeply tilted. It's actually to the north of the Tyler Shale is to the north of the Ironwood Formation. The Ironwood Formation is the iron ore body. It's something called a banded iron formation, where you have layers of silica, which the mining company is calling beach sand. That's not quite right, but it's, you know, reasonably close. Layers of silica interbedded with layers of iron oxide. And most of the iron oxide up there is magnetite, so it's magnetic. And that's below, stratigraphically below the Tyler Shale. Up there it's below and to the south of it. And we don't know. There may well be shales mixed in with the Ironwood Formation. It's not a pure banded iron formation. So there probably are some black shales with and associated pyrite mixed in with the iron ore itself. Most of the material that's of concern is the Tyler Shale, which is to the north and will form the north wall of the proposed mine.
Right. I'm going to bring in Jason. Jason Huberty is now with us. He is a geologist who has studied iron ore. Did you want to kind of take where Joe left off about some of the shale and how it's actually the formation of the Pinoki Mountain Range and what the iron ore is?
Thanks, Sarah, for having me. And I've been listening to Joe and don't really have too much to add except to say that, you know, the mountain range itself is held up by the iron formation and a quartzite. And the quartzite is part of the mine, too. And like Joe said, or I don't know if this was mentioned or not yet, the silica is also chemically inert. And so the main argument that the mining company gives and the need for this bill is to distinguish between the types of mining. And I'm not sure if that's been discussed yet or not.
No, we haven't.
Okay. Is that something you'd like me to talk about, Sarah?
Oh, absolutely. Go right ahead.
Great. So, you know, this is called a ferrous mining bill, and it's to separate ferrous mining from the other types of mining. So what they're not really teaching us, which is important, is that iron isn't mined from sulfur. And this bill says, well, because it isn't mined from sulfur, we don't have to treat it like there's any sulfur there. So if you mine gold or other precious metals, typically they're found with sulfide, and that's something that's pretty dangerous and has to be taken care of before any sort of removal of that material even happens. With iron oxides, you can pretty much just process them and all you get is a hole. So it's going to be a lake in the future. But the problem is it's not pure iron oxide. And like I heard Joe say, the overlying shale contains sulfur. We think that there's small amounts of that also interfingered with the iron. That's typical. And so I've looked at the rocks up in Wisconsin and Minnesota, Ontario, Michigan. They're all forming at the same time part of the southern continent that used to exist here 2 billion years ago. And the need to separate these two really isn't clear to me because they're not being honest with us, in my opinion, about the material that they're actually processing, which does contain sulfur.
So what... This is probably a question for you, Joe. With the sulfur that's around it and obviously above it, how would that affect with the mining company coming in and digging it out? How would that chemically break down and affect the environment around it?
It's we get what's called acid mine drainage, which is more typical of things like gold mines and copper mines, where you mine heavy deposits of sulfide. But essentially, you have this chemical, ferrous sulfide, which is iron combined with sulfur, and it's not stable on the Earth's surface. What it wants to do is it wants to combine with oxygen. And when it combines with oxygen, what you get is rust, iron oxide, which isn't a problem, and sulfuric acid. And the sulfuric acid is a problem for a number of reasons. It's acidic, so it lowers the pH of the water. It's a source of sulfate, which when converted by bacteria into hydrogen sulfide, which happens in the mud in wetlands, is toxic to wild rice, and a lot of freshwater organisms are extremely sensitive to hydrogen sulfide. The sulfuric acid breaks down the rock, and with it, it leaches out other toxic materials that are in the rock, such as selenium and arsenic, possibly mercury. So it's a well-known environmental problem with mines. This is not, you know, the minute you start talking about there being sulfides present, this brings in a host of very well-known environmental problems that have been well-studied and well-documented in many areas around the world. And it was in an attempt to avoid people noticing that this current mining bill very cleverly tried to redefine what a sulfide is. In a sense, what this bill is, it's almost as if the bill is exempting the mine from the law of gravity. It attempts to redefine a sulfide so that, by definition, what is found in association with this iron is not a sulfide. And so the whole push for the bill is based, as Jason said, on this false distinction. It's a real distinction chemically between an oxide and a sulfide. They're right. You know, iron oxide is not terribly toxic, and silica is not terribly toxic. But in the real world, you don't find iron oxide, at least not in the Pinokies, without finding a lot of sulfide in the rocks associated with it.
So basically, the mining company is saying, our mine, if it was just, you know, as an iron ore mine, it wouldn't be very toxic or harmful. Mm-hmm. But because this really isn't an iron ore mine, there are actually sulfides in there, in which they're not admitting to. This is actually puts the mine into another category.
Yeah, well, they're not admitting to it, and they're not admitting to it. They're just kind of evading the whole question. And because the legislature knows nothing about science, and because the press in Wisconsin is largely incompetent and has never looked at this issue, and apparently does not know anything about science either, they've been able to hide this big problem, and no one has called them out on it until, well, a few people have, but you know, Jason and I were both watching the assembly debate a few weeks ago, and we heard these assemblymen talking about this. You know, this is an oxide mine, this is not a sulfide mine. And we thought, wait a minute, you know, you don't even know what you're talking about, and you're trying to make this distinction. It's about time that someone actually taught you some chemistry.
Now, the reps for the mining project have acknowledged the potential damage the project would cause. However, they are telling the public that they have found ways to negate that damage, so there won't be a risk to the public or the environment. What do you guys have to say about that? What's your answer to that?
Which one of us?
Oh, we'll start with Jason first, and I'll go to Joe.
Well, you know, all the other groups that have been so prominent up there have really demonstrated the major concerns that, to me, dominated over the actual science. The getting out of the contested case hearings for the DNR, the limiting of the process to a year, you know, ostensibly the reason behind the bill is to streamline the process because our laws are too strict and we're keeping businesses out of Wisconsin. So this is part of making Wisconsin open for business. And somehow these laws are our laws are considered more restrictive than Minnesota's and Michigan's, and they are, and it's good to keep them that way, and we should actually look at making them more so. But to remove these things like the contested case hearings, which is a quasi-legal setting where citizens can provide testimony and people are under oath, and that can be used in later court cases, or limiting the right to sue to people who are directly affected. And then the very overreaching picture, which I know has been talked about, and the tribal issue, that these are ceded territory rights that are being threatened. To me, those are all strongly negative environmental impacts, and so I don't really trust the company when they say that, because that's not what's in the bill.
Joe?
I would say that if they can figure out a way of dealing with the amount of sulfide that they may expose in this mine, well, that should be part of the discussion. We shouldn't be bringing up probably the most serious environmental impact of this mine a week before it's being voted on. You know, they haven't been very forthcoming about talking about the sulfides, much less about providing details about how they're going to deal with the enormous amount of runoff that this mine could generate. Off the top of my head, I can't see how you could do it. There's mines in the West, gold mines and silver mines in Nevada, sulfide mines, which are much smaller, where they do deal with the sulfide runoff by collecting it all. They put a barrier down under the ore and then collect the drainage, because that's the stuff you want. That's the stuff where the gold and silver is. The mine in the Pinokies is cubic kilometers of rock. There's going to be cubic kilometers of tailings, and I can't see how they could deal with it. But if they can, they should be talking about that. They should be putting that up front, and they're not. Then what they've been doing is doing everything in their power, not only to hide the sulfide in the run-up to passing the bill, but also putting provisions in the bill that makes it very easy for them to hide the sulfide after the fact. There's a lot of the provisions, as Jason mentioned, the lack of contested case hearings, the reliance on the mining company for data, restrictions on the DNR's ability to evaluate the quality of the data. All of that makes it very easy for the mining company to fudge its data, because the pyrite, the concentrations of these sulfide minerals in the rock, is not homogeneous. You can go from place to place. Some of the rock has no pyrite in it. Some of the rock is loaded with pyrite. It would be very easy for the mining company to cherry pick the data it shows. So, you know, they're being disingenuous if they claim that they can deal with it. If they really can deal with it, they should be talking about that up front, and they're not. They have not been.
So, do you think that with the iron ore mine, with the way that they're kind of bypassing the sulfide and pushing that, do you think that would be a way for them then to go to the gold mines and lessen some of the gold mine restrictions because of the sulfites that they're finding and what would happen with the Pinoki Mountain Range?
I think that's more of a legal question than
okay.
I am.
Okay, then you can. Okay. No problem. Jason, can you really quickly go through how the Pinoki Mountain Range is set up geologically?
Yeah, that'd be great. So there are rocks that are found with iron in northern Wisconsin, the upper peninsula of Michigan, Minnesota, and southern Ontario, pretty much on all sides of Lake Superior. And at about 2 billion years ago, this was the southern margin of the United States, and the rest of it just didn't exist. So on that continental slope, there were all the sediments that accumulated, some coming from the continent, some coming from vents at the bottom of the ocean. The vents at the bottom of the ocean released a lot of iron, and since the world didn't contain atmospheric oxygen at levels that were breathable for life that we know and are primarily familiar with, that iron remained in the water until it did mix with oxygen produced by bacteria and kind of floated out as a chemical sediment. And we have that in common with all the other places that have iron ore, except that then there were later processes that happened, such as the formation of the rest of the United States. And during those events, things happened to Michigan and Minnesota that were to kind of cook them and remove some of the silica and concentrate it relative to how much of the ore was in Wisconsin and Ontario. And that's really why you see the mines that are more active in those two states right now. But then since then, there's just been pretty much quiet. And if you go up there, you can even see the little thin layers, and it's pretty neat to see an outcrop. So something that's worth people to go up and check out and treasure, because they're really nice mountains to climb and hang out in. Copper Falls, that's a great state park that we have. That's going to be threatened by this mine.
How close is Copper Falls to the mining area itself, or is it in the mining area?
It's about 5 miles north of Mellon, or of the area. Joe, do you want to chime in there?
Yeah, it's very close, within 5 miles.
The Tyler Forks River passes through there, and that's one of the rivers that's going to be removed partly by that mine, you know, when they get to the shale directly above the banded iron, as a potential at least.
It's very close.
Okay. And what kind of iron ore? You talked about that Minnesota and Michigan got theirs cooked, so that obviously that's more of a pure iron ore versus what we're seeing here in the Pinoki Mountain Range that doesn't have as much iron ore. There's a lot more stuff in the iron ore. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I know you did a really good job at talking about that at the Joint Finance Committee hearing.
Thanks, Sarah. So we have this basic chemical sediment coming out of the ocean, half of it's iron and half of it's silica. And then if you have something happen where it gets buried deep in the earth, the heat and the pressure and water will remove the silica and concentrate the iron. So in the 1800s and early 1900s, the type of iron ore that was mined was this cooked out iron ore that's the frosting on the cake. And it's sweeter, it's concentrated, it doesn't require a taconite process to concentrate the iron to be made into steel. So once that frosting was scraped off, everyone's left eating cake. And in Minnesota and Michigan at least, there still is more concentrated high quality ore compared to what's in Wisconsin. There's places in Wisconsin where it's a little better than what's in the Pinoki Range, but it's really at the bottom of what it means to be economic for mining iron, something like 20 to 30% iron. And even the taconite ores that they're mining in, excuse me, the Arrowhead of Minnesota right now, those don't contain the frosting either, but they're still of a higher grade. And then, of course, they've got existing processes, and but they also still have that same shale. So even though it's a different name over there because it was discovered differently, it exists in those different places, and it has caused environmental problems in Minnesota, like runoff containing selenium, killing off of fish near Silver Bay. So that's been documented, and that could happen in Wisconsin if this mine goes through.
Yeah, one of the things that proponents of the mine have brought up in response to our testimony is they'll point out various mines, the Plymouth mine, the Tyler Forks mine, different mines in up in northern, especially the UP, that operated 100 years ago and didn't produce toxic drainage. And it's important to realize that those were shallow mines going after very high-grade iron ore. And they're not, it's not the same thing at all as what's being proposed in the Pinokis. You can dig a big hole in the ground. You can dig a big hole in some kinds of iron ore without really causing a problem. That's true. But you can't do it in the Pinokis without causing that problem.
Because of the way the rocks are, the chemical compositions of the rocks that are different and what's formed. You guys have been great. We have to get going. I'd love to have you both on again to talk more. I could talk for hours with you guys. The amount of information you have is amazing, and this is definitely information that really has to get out to people so they really fully understand what's going on up in the Pinoki Mountain Range. So Joe Scollin, who is the geochemist, and Jason Huberty, who is the geologist. Thank you guys so much for everything, and hopefully we'll have you back on soon talking more about this.
Okay, bye.
Thank you, Sarah.
Right. So we will be right back with Kelly from Politiscope and Zach from Blogging Blue. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I've got to beware. think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. 1,000 people in the street, singing songs and they're carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Better stop now. What's that sound?
Welcome back to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz. And right now we have Kelly with Politiscoop and Zach with Blogging Blue who are on. We're going to be talking about some of their blogs. We're going to be talking about some of the stories from this week, like we did with Yuri, only a little more in depth with some of them. Good morning, guys. Thanks for being on.
Good morning. Thank you.
No, this is going to be less of a panel and more of an open discussion, so chime in if there's something you want to say. But I want to start with Kelly and talk about the Politiscoop blog with the voucher schools and the redistricting. Can you talk a little bit about what you found and how the two are linked?
There's so much corruption going on in our government. It's amazing how much we have found. And, you know, I find it really amazing with the Citizens United decision. It's really, really hard to really find out how much money is being funneled into our state government. But even the numbers that we did find, it's pretty appalling. And it all links back to the DeVos family and All Children Matter, which is now, since they were fined, for funneling $870,000 through a Virginia PAC affiliate in Ohio, they changed their name. And why the big red flag came up, why is the American Federation for Children or All Children Matter, what is the connection between the voucher school program and the mining legislation and the redistricting? How can all those be connected? And there's two major connections that we found. The biggest one is Scott Jensen. Scott Jensen is a lobbyist for American Federation for Children. He is a previous lobbyist for the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce in 84 and 87. He was a representative for the state of Wisconsin, and he was charged with misuse of public workers and state resources as a part of a large state scandal. And, he was involved in the redistricting maps. Why would American Federation for Children lobbyists be involved in redistricting maps. We didn't get that. So we started delving into and following the money, which is basically what we do every time we're trying to solve these mysteries of corruption. Another link to that, actually, I discovered the link yesterday with our latest article. Last night came out about Senator Wengard. Interestingly, I was, and actually ironically, I was in Burlington, in my hometown, where Senator Wengard was having a town hall meeting. Now, Burlington was not in Senator Wengard's district, but with the redistricting maps, he is claiming representation of Burlington. So he has a town hall meeting, and he goes on about the mining bill, and when he was questioned about the mining bill, I don't really think he expected there to be people in the audience that knew what was going on and was actually following all this stuff. And so, you know, a question was raised from the audience after he was, you know, praising the mining bill and, you know, going on about how great it was. The question was asked, did you at all work with the sovereign nations when you were writing this bill?
Hey, Kelly, I actually have that. Let's listen to that. That was a great lead-in. Let's listen to that right now.
Did you at all work with the sovereign nations when you were writing this bill?
The sovereign, you mean with the Indians?
With the tribes.
Absolutely. I actually had... I had several of the... And you're taping me, I know.
Mm-hmm.
We had several of the Indian tribes, the Badlands, or the Bad... is it Bad Water?
Bad River.
Bad River, there we go. Bad River tribes. I did actually happen to chat with me about it, and...
And they were in on the planning.
I don't know if they were in on the planning.
That was my question.
I do not sit on the mining task force. I wasn't on that thing. I mean, I did not have the appointment to be on that committee or that, I guess it's a commission, is what it was. But I have chatted with many of the Indian tribes.
That was Senator Van Wengard answering the question Kelly has said. It's actually off of Politiscoop's website, Politiscoop's blog that talks about this. So.
Yes, and it went on further to ask Senator Wengard if he was going to vote on the bill.
And I have that too, but I have it cut, so it's about 10 seconds, so it's all going to kind of come together about will he vote,
perfect.
And then he'll answer, so here it is.
Are you going to vote for it?
I actually co-sponsored the bill that it's there. We're just following the order.
I'd like an answer.
Am I going to vote on it? It's my bill.
That's about as good as I can. He really, that's what he said. He never said, yes, I'll vote for it. No, I'm not going to vote for it. That was his answer. It's my bill. So I'm guessing, I'm going out on a limb and saying he's going to vote for it.
Actually, I don't believe he's going to vote for it. Because we were also privy to a recording at the on the park in Madison where Senator Ellis, in addition to going on about the voucher schools and how it was a bad piece of legislation and it wasn't good and they needed to close the loophole and he didn't support it, he was going to be forced to vote for it. Well, this was a conversation with Representative Voss, and in that they discussed the mining bill and how awful the mining bill was. And how they were being forced to vote for something that they didn't want to, but he felt that they were not going to vote for the mining bill, that it was basically a Trojan horse, to summarize. So I believe that this mining bill, it was never intended to be passed. It was an attempt for the Republicans to accomplish many things, but also to allow them to say, oh, the Democrats, they don't want to create jobs and pit the taxpayers and the unemployed against the Democrats, just like they used the vouchers to pit the taxpayers against the children. It's all bad legislation.
Zach, do you have anything you want to add with that? What, do you agree with what Kelly's finding? What are you seeing with some of this?
I've been following the ins and outs of the mining bill, but I think it's Kelly's assessment that I don't think they ever intended on it passing, I think is right on, because I think that what you've got here is a bill that nobody really knows who wrote the bill, first of all. I can surmise that it was written, you know, that a shell piece of legislation it's very similar to legislation that's been proposed by ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council, the right-wing group that's basically a trade group submitting legislation for legislators across the country to use. Because the interesting thing is the bill was actually submitted without a sponsor originally, if I remember correctly. And then Mark Honadel, a Republican state representative from South Milwaukee, signed on, which was no surprise because one of the interesting facts about Mark Honadel's district is he actually Caterpillar, formerly known as Bucyrus, is located in his district, and they make mining equipment for precisely the kind of mine we're talking about, you know, putting in the North Woods. So I think that if you look at how the bill came to be, I get the sense that they didn't really expect it to go anywhere, and they wanted to put it on Democrats that Democrats voted against jobs, and you know, they voted to kill this legislation, and you know. And the other part of it, I think, is they know, I think, what the impact of this mine would be for the Northwoods. And I think that they wanted to be able to say to their corporate contributors, because there's been a lot of money, you know, flowing into Wisconsin in the form of campaign contributions to these guys. And so I think they want to be able to say to their campaign contributors, look, we tried. We tried to get this bill through, you know, we submitted it, and, you know, those darn Democrats, they voted against it, you know, because there's been, we actually had Mike McCabe from the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign come to Drinking Liberty here in Milwaukee on Monday, and he talked about the fact that there's been a tremendous influx of money into Wisconsin, into the pockets of legislators, you know, for campaign contributions coming from an individual, and I forget his name, from West Virginia, who is associated with the company that would benefit from this legislation. And so I think that it's really an attempt for them to line their campaign pockets, you know, to get, you know, a nice sum of money in their coffers, and then, you know, be able to say, well, we tried to do it for you, but it just didn't work. Those darn Democrats voted against it. You know, so they it's a win-win for them, you know, because they get the money, and then they get to be able to say, well, you know, it wasn't our fault. So I think that the money is a big part of it, too. You know, I do get the sense that they understand just how awful this is going to be. You know, you're going to have a large open pit mine polluting the groundwater and just wreaking havoc on the environment up there.
So basically you just think that this was a bill to put through to create a political statement. To kind of say, well, look at donors, we're trying, they're not, we're struggling with this. Look at, you know, we're fighting this, but look at unemployed, you know, that kind of thing.
I think it's really twofold. It's about campaign contributions, and, you know, they really hung their hats, so to speak, on this mining bill as the cure for all of Wisconsin's unemployment woes and for the jobs numbers that have been, you know, six consecutive months of job losses. So they really, it's twofold. It's a political thing, but it's also a money thing. And I think that, you know, with most of the legislation they've proposed or passed, I think most of them know what the practical impact of that is, and it's not good for Wisconsin. I think a lot of them just really don't care as long as the money still comes in.
Well, it's interesting that they kept saying jobs and how this was going to create jobs. And this, the amount of jobs that it was going to create seemed to grow as the time went on. It was kind of like that story that some guy caught a fish. Now it's 5 feet. Now it's 20 feet. It was a whale. You know how these things get on. When it was first released last January, I was talking to Mike Wiggins Jr., who is the chairman of the Bad River Reservation Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. And he said that they came out in a public forum. The mining company said they would create 30 jobs, and then 30 jobs they were going to bring in. That's what they started with. Then they backed off a couple weeks, and then a couple weeks later, it was thousands of jobs. And now this mine in Wisconsin, in northern Wisconsin, is just going to seem to create every job in the state of Wisconsin that's going to bring us all out of our unemployment woes. It's going to cause people in Milwaukee will have jobs. People all over the state are going to have jobs because this mine is coming in. And it really is interesting how the amount of jobs has just exponentially has gone up since this has been we've been talking about it.
Yeah, and then also in the midst of all this, all these jobs and mining and everything, talking about it, the voucher bill gets swept under the rug, and the impact that has on our children's future and the future of Wisconsin. It's terrible what this voucher bill is doing.
Well,
we're not closing a loophole.
Well, go talk about a minute about the loophole, Kelly. I know this is something you're very passionate about, and I know you really know this stuff. So why don't you, and you've been following it for a while, why don't you talk about that loophole that's in the voucher bill?
Wanguard made sure he sold out the Racine children for his corporate masters who are funneling him all this money, like the DeVos of Michigan and the Waltons of Walmart. They funneled him thousands and thousands of dollars to serve their agenda, and he sold out the Racine children by making sure that Walker put in the budget bill to include Racine in the voucher bill that Milwaukee has. Now, when they did that, when they put it in the budget bill, they didn't say, you know, Racine. They left it open for expansion to all over the state. And what this does, and to try and summarize it in one sentence is really difficult, but basically it's taking taxpayer funds out of the public schools and handing them over to private and e-schools, charter schools, that don't have any accountability to the people with what they're doing with the money. They have no accountability or regulation on what the teachers are actually teaching. And it's awful for the children. There's no accountability in it whatsoever. And by leaving that loophole open to expand elsewhere, I know Green Bay is one of the places that is close to qualifying for it. And if they don't close that loophole, they could indeed expand to Green Bay, which is just awful. I mean, the public school system is really great. The problem is they're defunding them and underfunding them and forcing them to take more money from the taxpayers instead of from the state, who's already gotten tax funds for schools. Now they're giving those tax funds to other state agencies who are actually now private corporations. It's all a privatization of the state of Wisconsin, private schools, private everything.
On that, we're going to take a quick break, and I will be right back with Kelly and Zach. You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
Hi, I'm Eric Brandt, host of Civil Discourse. You can find us on iTunes. Over the last couple of weeks, the Republicans in the House of Representatives and the Senate, as well as various state governments and even the two frontrunners for the GOP nomination, have been attacking women's rights to contraception. Women make up 52% of the population. 99% of them have used contraception throughout their lives, and 98% of Catholic women have used contraception. So why would the GOP choose this debate? The answer is simple. They're trying to change the conversation. After 23 months of private sector growth under a Democratic president, the economy is improving, so they don't want to talk about that. They ran the 2010 campaign on jobs, 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 but they have not passed any bills to create jobs. They put the emphasis on our nation's debt, but the Occupy movement successfully brought the conversation back around to the economy and jobs. The last resort for the right wing is to try and appeal to religious fundamentalists. Fortunately, over 70% of the U.S. population wants women to have the right to contraception. This helps President Obama's ratings as he agrees that women have a right to contraception and he continues to talk about the economy and jobs. His recent budget allows about $500 billion on infrastructure spending, spending that will help create jobs, giving more people more money to spend in the private sector. It boils down to a simple question for anyone who is unemployed and undecided in 2012. What means more to you as a person? A balanced federal budget and limited contraception, or a steady job with a steady paycheck for you and your family? I'm Eric Brandt, host of Civil Discourse. That's just something to think about.
with the teachers. I know as soon as it became aware of what the governor was doing, they were very unsettled. And as a board member, I was too, because really in Wisconsin, local board members don't have a lot of, we don't have a lot of flexibility. The control on school spending that's been built in the law since that was established about 20 years ago is pretty tight, and it's gotten tighter every year, especially for schools, districts like ours, which were really pretty cheap when we started, to have it just tightened up a little bit more each year, to not be able to budget, for instance, to put a little money aside for repairs that you know you're going to have to make every 20 years, like roof repairs and things like that. We simply can't do that, or we'd have to take something out of away from actual instruction. And we've really put our emphasis into maintaining the quality of instruction, raising the performance of our kids, helping teachers improve their professional abilities, and really putting as much of our resources as we possibly can in people rather than into facilities. On the other hand, that leaves us in a situation where we have to go to referendum just to do basic, really, maintenance projects.
That was a Walworth County, he's from Walworth County, he is one of the school board members in Walworth County, talking about what the cuts have done to the school board and to the school itself. And that's part of what Kelly was talking about with the money leaving and the cuts that Walker did and the voucher school systems. You're looking at places in Walworth County, which isn't a poverty-stricken area. Well, we have areas of it, but a lot of it is relatively wealthy people, that you have a school board that's looking at not being able to update their schools because they don't have the money for it. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to bring that into the discussion, because when you talk about the schools and the voucher system, it's just more money that's coming away from the schools. And you're already looking at it, such a tight budget that schools, if there's a roof repair, they're going to have to go to a referendum to get it fixed.
Absolutely. You know, and another thing that keeps getting lost in all this is, you know, in that video from In on the Park, Representative Voss claims that he can get $200 million to support voucher schools. If he could get that money for voucher schools, why can't he get that money for the public schools? And where is he going to get that money from? It's going to be from the DeVos and the Waltons and his ALEC partners. It's really disgusting what they're trying to do to our school system in the name of greed.
Well, Zach, wasn't it, and maybe Kelly knows too, but I want to get Zach back in this conversation.
Yes.
Wasn't there something about Walmart that's setting up a trainee program with one of the junior colleges or something of that effect, where people could go and get trained and then work at Walmart?
You know, to be honest, I don't really know, because I haven't followed that too closely. I know Kelly is far more knowledgeable than I am about all the issues relating to voucher schools and the DeVosses and the Waltons. I'll say this, that wouldn't shock me in the slightest bit.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, because I think that that's what you're seeing is this push away from education, you know, encouraging creativity and free thought, you know, and you're seeing a move towards, you know, teaching to the test and learning the basics. And what we're essentially doing is creating an entire generation of young people who won't be able to create or think freely, but instead will be perfect little service workers. You know, they'll be perfectly trained to work at a Walmart or to work at a Target or to work at a McDonald's, but they won't have the ability to think freely and create for themselves, you know, and be the next generation of innovators. So that wouldn't surprise me in the slightest bit.
Yeah, and actually in our article about the school vouchers that just came out this week, we quoted a site, educationsector.org, which reported all the money and the intent of the Walton Foundation. And it says right on their site In Detroit, Michigan, four inner-city Detroit schools have teamed up with area Walmarts to offer students a four-credit after-school class that teaches job readiness and shows students how to apply for entry-level positions. Yes, they are teaching students how to work at Walmart. That's what they want. They want the kids not to go to college and to learn how to work entry-level positions, minimum wage jobs, no benefits, nothing.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's so good for sustainable jobs and to get people out of poverty, is, you know, to work $8 an hour jobs and have to work two jobs to make ends meet. Of course, I'm being a little sarcastic about that.
It's true, though.
So, Zach, why don't you talk about the last blog that you guys have written up in Blogging Blue. You guys are all over this place at Blogging Blue. You've got five or six different writers, including Waukesha Wonk on there. So why don't you talk about one or two subjects that you guys have been talking about?
Well, I think that obviously a couple of our folks are really into economic issues, so there's been a lot of talk about that. But one of the ones I've noticed is more popular is the footage of State Representative Joel Clayfish punching buttons for his colleagues, voting for them. And then he was actually on the local news down here. They interviewed him about that, and he was playing the victim role, that, you know, he shouldn't have been taped to begin with. There shouldn't have been cameras there. And there is basically, what it boils down to is he was caught on someone's cell phone clearly pushing his own voting button and then moving down a seat and voting and then moving down a seat and voting again. And from what I've been told, this is apparently a quote-unquote common practice among both Republican and Democratic lawmakers in the Assembly, but that doesn't negate the fact that it seems kind of ironic that a state representative, a Republican state representative, who voted in favor of voter ID to eliminate vote fraud in the state of Wisconsin, cast votes for somebody else. That the irony there just is stunning to me, because, you know, here's a guy who, you know, screams about vote fraud and then essentially votes for someone else, votes for two someone else's. You know, so I know there's been a lot of talk about, oh, you know, it's common practice and it's no big deal, but that doesn't make it right. You know, I don't care if it's Joel Clayfish this week and, you know, some Democratic lawmaker next week. It's not right. It should be one representative, one vote, not one representative, as many votes as he can cast. You know, that just defies logic.
And Yuri brought that up earlier, and for the people who weren't able to hear that, I believe it's actually in the bylaws of the Assembly and the Senate that you cannot vote for someone who is not there at the vote. And I believe that this, if you are not there when the voting happens, you just don't vote.
Yeah, and there's a couple folks have commented on my blog about the fact that it is actually there is a rule allowing you to cast a proxy vote for a colleague. And I, to be honest, I don't know the specifics of the Assembly's rules. I want to say it's, I don't even know the Assembly rule number, but so there's been some back and forth about whether this was actually something that's allowable or not. But like I said, even if let's say hypothetically there is a rule allowing it, it's supposedly there's Assembly Rule 76 subsection 6, you know, about it. But listen, it doesn't make it right. Whether there's a rule in place allowing it or not, it's just not, it doesn't seem to me to be, you know, the right way to go about doing things, especially for someone who preaches about, you know, vote fraud and one person, one vote. But yeah, it's not a good thing at all. And then for Joel Clayfish to be on WTMJ down here and essentially playing the victim role in all of this, you know, get over it already, you know. You were caught doing something you shouldn't have been doing. Just man up and admit you did it. You know, take responsibility for your actions. Republicans always preach about personal responsibility. Then take personal responsibility for what you did. Don't blame somebody else. Don't blame the guy who filmed you doing something wrong. You know, that's like a criminal saying, well, I'm really sorry. And it's, well, are you sorry you got caught, or are you sorry you did it? You know, so I don't know. It just stinks to me.
Well, and it would be a lot better if he could actually come up with the rules that allows him to do it versus the rules that doesn't. It's almost like he doesn't really know what the rules are in the Senate for that. And personally, my personal opinion is that if you're a senator, if you're an assemblyman, and Clay Fish is an assemblyman, it's your job to be there when you vote. We're really not asking much as taxpayers, as people who pay for your salary. We're just asking that you just be present and do your job. And it's amazing that they can't even do that. I mean, there's plenty of time after the vote. There's plenty of time during discussion. They have informal times in the Senate and Assembly where people talk for 20 minutes. Go run to the bathroom then or do whatever you have to do. If you have a medical emergency or you have a reason that you have to leave, then that's one thing. But with three or four people in his row that he just decided to go vote for, you know, that's a totally different situation. So it, to me, stay, do your job, at least stay for the vote, and then do what you have to do.
I'm really curious who he voted for. Why weren't they there?
Yeah, that's something that I think a lot of folks are wondering, you know, and there's been some people who have said, oh, that'll clear everything up because maybe they allowed him to vote for them. But I actually am just looking now because I wanted to make sure I had my facts right. And one of the assembly rules says, and I quote, only the members present in the assembly chamber may vote. So that is the rule. Only people present can vote. Now, whether they gave him their permission or not doesn't matter. The rule seems pretty unambiguous. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the bigger point here, too, you know, if we think about what's been going on over the past year is, you know, in regards to the issue of them having protesters removed from the gallery, not allowing recordings of what's going on in the gallery, I think this is a prime example of why they don't want public scrutiny, why they don't want cameras in the gallery, because they want to be able to do things the way they want to be able to do them, regardless of what the rules say. And they don't, you know, for all Scott Walkers and all these Republicans who talked about open, honest, and transparent government, that's not what they want. That is precisely the opposite of what they want. If they wanted open and transparent government, why are they still working on legislation after midnight? You know, Scott Walker talked about, you know, during the gubernatorial campaign about nothing good happens in the assembly or in the legislature after midnight. But yet here they are doing all sorts of stuff after midnight, including the mining legislation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they wanted to do some work on that after midnight. These guys don't want the public to know what they're doing precisely because they know what they're doing is wrong. And they think they can just get away with it if they continue to try to ban people from being in the chamber with cameras and from calling them out on these things. And it's not going to work. It's not going to work.
Well, and they passed the wetland bill, too, at midnight. Scott Fitzgerald actually called it and said, okay, we're going to reconvene at 12:01. And then it took all of 20 minutes to pass it and be gone.
Well, and that's exactly it. You know, I mean, and Scott Fitzgerald is a whole another topic entirely. But I mean, this is the way they want to do things. They want to just be able to run roughshod over the rules and you know, pass their extreme agenda without any oversight or any public input. I mean, look how they've tried to limit public input on so many different pieces of legislation, whether it's the budget repair bill, the so-called budget repair bill, or the mining legislation, or any number of other pieces of legislation they've passed where they've tried to really limit public input and discussion. The redistricting, another perfect example, where they did not want public scrutiny or public input. They wanted to just jam through their agenda and be done with it.
Exactly.
Well, that's part and parcel for what they've done. This is we can do it. No one can really stop us, so we're just going to do everything we can until somebody does.
Exactly.
So, well, I'd like to thank you both for being on today. Thank you, Kelly, with Politiscoop. Really quickly, what's the website people can go to get more information and read up on the redistricting and the school vouchers?
It is Politiscoop, PolitiScoop.com.
And Zach, thank you very much for being on. And where can people go and read up on the economics and all the things that you guys cover? I mean, you just have the gamut on there. So if you go on, there's always going to be something someone can find an interest in. Where can they go get to that?
Sure. It's bloggingblue.com. That's bloggingblue.com. I'd like to thank you for having us on.
Well, thank you, and I hope you guys come back on again. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you for giving the people another forum to make their voices heard and educate the public on the issues we face. There's just so much to cover. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Absolutely.
I wish I had more time. There's always I always run out of time because there's just so much to cover, and then there's five more things to do next week. So, but we'll have you back on. We'll talk more about these because these are all important issues.
You're a
great,
champion
thanks.
For Wisconsin, Sarah. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kelly.
Bye.
All right, bye. That was Zach from Blogging Blue and Kelly from Politiscoop. Now, I am going to take a really quick break, and then we'll get on to Christine, and Christine will finish out the hour. So here is the quick break at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz. Phone number to call in, 877-497-1797.
Giving this week's Democratic radio address is Senator Chris Larson. All around our great state of Wisconsin, people are eager to get back to work. Many have been unemployed for months or even years. And what have the Republicans in charge of the legislature and governor's office done about this? Nothing. Time after time, they've hidden their heads in the sand and ignored job creation in Wisconsin while the rest of the country enjoys economic recovery. So what exactly are the priorities of the Republican Party here in Wisconsin? Well, Wisconsin waited for jobs. $2.3 billion in tax breaks were given to big corporations. While Wisconsin waited for jobs, they passed a voter suppression bill that makes it harder for seniors, people of color, and students to exercise their constitutional rights to the ballot box. And this week, they passed a bill that dangerously restricts women's access to health care and treats physicians like criminals. In fact, of the 35 bills on the calendar this week, none address the fact that Wisconsin has lost jobs each month since Governor Walker's budget went into effect. Wisconsin workers, students, and small businesses are all paying the price for the Republicans' disturbingly skewed priorities and failed policies. Meanwhile, legislative Democrats understand the 250,000 unemployed workers in our state are tired of waiting for jobs. Democrats have supported numerous proposals that would support small business, educate future generations of workers, and provide specialized job training to remain competitive in a 21st century work environment. This legislative session is a story of lost opportunities. Wisconsin cannot wait for economic growth to occur. The waiting must end now, and Republicans must stop ignoring the public and join us in getting serious about job creation.
You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz, and I have Christine Newman from, you're going to have to correct me because I know I'm going to slaughter this, Bocas de la Frontera?
That's right.
Am I close?
No, that's perfect, actually.
Okay. Well, that's a first. I took a bunch of German, and I wish I would have taken Spanish instead. That would have helped me out a lot more, except going to Germany, but that's okay. Now, I want to start off with the redistricting maps. I know that the Milwaukee's Latino community got completely separated in the new maps, and it was evident from the memos that was released that that was exactly what they're trying to do. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, Voces de la Frontera, for those that don't know, is a community-based organization. We represent low-wage workers around predominantly Latino. And we're most concentrated kind of in the Milwaukee, southeastern area, Milwaukee-Racine area. And we've really worked on worker rights, immigration rights, and education rights as our primary area of work. And as a consequence, part of our activity has also been involved, getting involved in electoral activity. And the Latino community in terms of a voting bloc. You know, we've really dedicated a lot of years in trying to increase the participation of Latinos in the election process. And so we did file a lawsuit because the redistricting map, which is developed every 10 years based on changes in the, you know, state's population at all levels of government, are then redrawn. And Latinos in Wisconsin, though grew by 70% statewide and 44% in the city of Milwaukee. And we really, in terms of our lawsuit, you know, that population is concentrated in an assembly district 8, which in the city of Milwaukee, where that population has significantly grown. It's grown a little bit south than the kind of the assembly district 8 with that, where those numbers are most concentrated. In the map that was passed by the Republican majority legislature, the map basically created split our current where assembly district into two, and brought in a lot of the southern neighborhoods where the demographics are very different, and where you do have a population which by and large is kind of older European immigrant population that is unfortunately not as informed on the issues that that matter to the Latino community, such as issues around bilingual education, you know, being sensitive and aware about, you know, how immigration issues affect, obviously, not just people in the Latino community, but Latino communities very intimately, you know, either through family or friends or neighbors, you know, your school friends, your congregation, you know, intimately aware of the injustices that the Latino community faces with our current broken immigration system and the need for reform. And so, those are just issues where we've seen a difference in terms of when you look at those wards that have been brought into these new assembly districts. It's really the consequence of it will be to, despite the tremendous growth, to dilute the Latino voting bloc and actually, bring in a group of voters that have higher voter registration, higher voter turnout, because a number of factors within the Latino community that are a barrier to voting. And have actually been hostile to the issues that are important. I mean, part of the whole redistricting process and the Voting Rights Act is that it's supposed to ensure that all people, in particular African Americans, minorities, you know, other historically discriminated groups, are able to have an equal voice in our legislature and in our diversity of our state, and bring all of those issues and needs to the forefront. So we filed this lawsuit because we believe this is actually going to dilute the Latino voting bloc the way it was drawn, and it will really threaten our ability to elect a Latino state legislature. Right now, Assembly District 8 is the only state legislature that has been able to elect a Latino legislature. Before, it was State Representative Pedro Colon, presently State Representative Jocasta Samaripa, that have been, champions on the issues, unique issues as well, besides representing everybody, but in particular also being informed and good advocates on the issues that affect the Latino community, such, bilingual education, language access issues, issues that are affecting lawful permanent residents, issues related to immigration, all of that, that they have been, it's been an important voice to bring into the state legislature. So that is part of the lawsuit that we brought in. It then became consolidated with a lawsuit brought in by Democratic citizens on a number of other claims. And those have been consolidated into one, and there's been a trial. It's continuing today. It'll end today to take up, the merit of those claims. The thing that brought a lot of attention in the process was, the what also was uncovered during the process of these, this federal lawsuit was also the process by which the Act 43, the state legislative map that came out of the legislature, was approved, revealing all of these, illegal dealings with, where they had hired, these secret individual negotiations, where they had hired the law firm Michael Best and Friedrich to out of the public process and not to the exclusion of all the full legislature, and under the cloak of a bogus attorney-client privilege agreement, basically negotiated, planned, and voted for the map that was ultimately passed. The Democratic citizens have other claims, and those claims involve the disenfranchisement of 300,000 people that, because the way the maps were drawn, are not going to be able, will have to wait an extra 2 years before voting in a Senate election. And obviously we know we have very important elections coming up. So those are really the two pieces. There were a number of other issues brought forward, which, you know, were very important, but in the end they decided to not move forward. I mean, from my point of view, it just highlighted that really our voting rights in terms of the Constitution are not as strong as they should be.
Can you tell people who aren't familiar with what's going on in Milwaukee with the redistricting how cut up the Latino community is?
Yeah, I mean, the largest concentration of Latinos in the state of Wisconsin is in Assembly District 8, which is, in the city of Milwaukee. And that, instead of creating, as you would, create a revise a political boundary that, includes all of that growth. And for Latinos, that is very important because there are significant barriers to voting. And what they did is they actually split it right down the middle and created two assembly districts. So on a superficial level, it looks like progress because they're saying, well, look, if you think to the future, 10 years, you have this Latino majority. Now you have two districts where you have a majority Latino voting age population, and isn't that a good thing? But the reality is that what Voces has advocated for, not just at the state level, but we successfully advocated for this at the city level and at the school board level, that, with the Latino population, you have, it's different than other ethnic populations in the state, but you have high numbers of ineligible voters. For instance, we have the, and this has probably grown since then, but as of 2006, we have the highest numbers of lawful permanent residents. And so those are folks that can become naturalized U.S. citizens, but we have a very high number, the highest concentration, 26% in the state of lawful permanent residents is in that district. So that's like, that's over 10,500 people who can't vote. And but you're counting them, or then what you're also counting, Latinos also have a very high number of young people who are U.S. citizens, but you can't say that a newborn baby should count in terms of the Latino population or the growth when it'll be 18 years before they have the chance to vote. Just looking at it, you also have poverty. It's one of the, it's very much a, a Latino low-wage working-class neighborhood. You have, in two zip codes in that area, just to give you an example, you have very high levels of poverty. So one is like 53204, where Voces is based. When UWM looked at the, the gross income level, individuals and families there, and it's the third poorest zip code area in Milwaukee County. And 53215, another one in that same district, is the sixth poorest. And the poorest is actually another neighborhood, a zip code area on the north side. And between those two, actually, we're, as people know, Milwaukee is now the fourth poorest city in the nation. And a lot of that poverty is concentrated in minority neighborhoods because of the deindustrialization that happened with a lot of the good manufacturing jobs moving out and just, the kind of low-wage work that's been created and obviously like the most recent crisis and all that, the kind of how we've been also additionally hit with the Great Recession has had particularly, really reached depression level conditions in some neighborhoods. So people, you know, in Assembly District 8 are working, and but they're, you know, working really long hours for very little pay, and also, you know, suffering from. So yeah, I mean, it's this is. So those are the kind of issues, including language access. So what that means is when you have a poor neighborhood, people move around a lot. And for our work in trying to engage people in the political process, that becomes more challenging. The other issue is you have a high number of new and infrequent voters. So voting is a very new process for naturalized U.S. citizens, and we know that people are intimidated from the process and you know, feel uncomfortable. You're not, if you come from a family that votes, you know, you're, you know, given an orientation, things like that, or and that, you know, that kind of experience is not there, and that's one of the things that VOCES works to help people out, you know, and even just explaining things like what is the difference between a primary election and a general election, and we've worked very hard around, you know, people knowing their rights in terms of you are able to bring a translator to the poll or ask for help. So things like that, those are, you know, low levels of voter registration, low levels of voter turnout. And so that piece of the lawsuit in terms of the negotiations with the attorney as of today will move forward. There was another one that was taken out, which, again, this probably has to do with, you know, I mean, to me it was very a very good point that was raised was, you know, one of the criticisms has been that with the, on the other side, with African Americans, you know, the map that was passed put them, really compacted them into voting districts. And the expert that that VOCES and, you know, our side hired, Professor Meyer, who's a very respected a researcher, you know, was basically saying, you know, this was from either the high concentration, you know, how they compacted, because, you know, the issue of citizenship is not an issue with African Americans. More of an issue would be like voter turnout, but, it, you know, that there were more, it was more than necessary, you know, the high concentration of, you know, putting them all in one district. For instance, in Alberta Darling's district, you know, like taking all African Americans out of her district, you know. You know, that has an impact. You know, it's good also for an elected official if to have a diverse constituency to be able to. So, you know, you have to look at the local area, the realities of each area. And in that case, unfortunately, that one did not move forward. So I think there are but the issue of disenfranchisement, you know, because of the way the lines were drawn, that is going to move forward.
And with the disenfranchisement, can you actually, you've talked a little bit about the things that you do. What would the Latino population, the Latino community lose by being separated like that? They would lose, you already said, excuse me, that they would lose, you know, it would be harder for them to vote because they wouldn't have as many social issues or social programs that would they could come to because they're now separated in so many areas. It'd be hard for people to go. Is there, what more would they lose with this?
I think there's a lot at stake. I mean, I think political representation would be the biggest thing that they would lose, because in our case, you really do have to concentrate that voting block to a supermajority. Really, that's what we've said. That's what we advocated for at the school board level and at the city level, and we had support on that issue, which is, you know, that we want to get to as close to a 70% population to actually then end up with a, you know, I think the studies that Dr. Meyer did, you know, basically say you basically end up then with a citizen Latino voting age population of around 43%. And so, you know, you know, when you're just looking at a total population, I should take that back. When you're looking at a total population, yeah, that's the around, you know, that's the number. So, you know, that's why we need to get to a much higher number. And like I said, you know, I think for any issue, whether you're working on the environment, whether you're working on union rights, whether you're working on immigration rights, it is the case that you know, any issue in the legislature needs a champion, you know, and you need people who are going to really fight and who, you know, for your issue and organize other legislatures to get their support. And that obviously that's a combination of both having folks in the legislature who are going to champion your issue and also having folks at the grassroots level who can, you know, on statewide legislation, you know, advocate with their elected officials to move that legislation forward to either fend off bad, you know, damaging legislation or achieve good reforms. And so, you know, for us, unquestionably, the that Assembly District 8 has produced a champion on Latino civil rights issues. And we saw the failure of that happen, for instance, when we had key legislation. For instance, we had an important victory in 2009 with the passage of in-state tuition rights, which benefits, you know, undocumented students that came, you know, came to the Wisconsin at a very young age, went through our public school system, have grown up here, have graduated, have done everything we tell them to do in terms of studying and applying themselves. And in-state tuition, what that does is say, well, you can, out of your own pocket, pay in-state tuition rates just like we would for anybody else who lives in our state for more than a year, or even, you know, like if there's an agreement with the states, with the surrounding states, you know, to pay in-state tuition at a public college. These students do not have a, you know, access to state financial aid or federal aid. So this is a very important, education is a very important issue for Latino families and really for, we know, for people to overcome poverty. Education is very important, and many of the kids are also caught in immigration backlogs. That's the problem with our immigration system, that it's really dysfunctional. We have a very low number of visas available, and we have a system that is, you know, has created a group of people, you know, caught in this situation. And so in that case, we had a tremendous victory in 2009 where we actually won in-state tuition rights in Wisconsin. And under Governor Walker, that was taken away. And in the same way that union workers have been scapegoated for the economy, immigrants for a long while now, as well as we know welfare mothers in the 1980s, you know, have been scapegoated for the economy, you know, for basically for him taking money away for, you know, giving a bunch of tax breaks to people that don't need it, you know, the very wealthy, large corporations, and then, you know, making this, you know, blaming people who working people and the poor, and that's true for immigrants. So the justification was, as part of the budget that was passed under the Walker administration, was they took away in-state tuition rights. But that's an important thing that we would like to win back. The driver card provision is something that many people wouldn't be familiar with, but that's something that you know, has also been achieved in other states where, and Wisconsin had it up till 2007, where if you people who are undocumented, you know, would be under some new federal changes and rules, the state could pass a provision that says that you would be able to get a driver's license, you know, which this is my identity, this is who I am. You know, law enforcement was very supportive of this issue because, you know, public safety is their priority, not immigration, and people would be able to get insurance. Auto insurance, and obviously, and we don't have a great public transportation system. So the only consequence of not supporting that is that you have more unlicensed drivers, unlicensed, uninsured drivers. That's the only practical effect. And
Christine,
so we would like to win that.
Okay, I don't mean to cut you off, but we have about a minute and a half left, and I just wanted to say thank you so much. Well, I definitely want to get you back. There's so much more I wanted to talk about, but the gist of it is, if with the redistricting, the Latino community loses their voice. And that cannot happen to any group. So thank you so much for being on. What's the website people can go to if they want more information?
www.vdlf.org.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for being on, Christine. We'll have you on soon.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Christine Newman with Voces de la Frontera. And you can go to our website for more information. Well, this is the end of the show. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to The Sarah Schultz Show today. I'd like to thank my step-in producer, Tom, for his work on the show today. You could listen to the show from iTunes or listen to the archive shows at blogtalkradio.com/Sarah Schultz or pick up the app, the Sarah Schultz Show app for Androids and iPhones. You can also tune in Saturday at 6 p.m. to WIDE in Madison, Tuesday at 1 p.m. to WHYS and WFAQ 92.9 LPFM. WHYS 96.3 FM on Tuesdays and Sundays, WFAQ in Mukwonago, Waukesha. Remember, Wisconsin, forward, together forward. Have a great week, and I'll talk to you next Friday.